This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Across every woman's life falls the shadow of a sword, wrote Virginia Woolf. On one side lie tradition and order, where all is correct. On the other, a life that does not follow convention. And there, wrote Woolf, all is confusion. That's where writer Elizabeth Gilbert set her compass. A professional woman, mid-30s, limping out of a failed marriage, a brutal divorce, and a flamed-out love affair, Elizabeth Gilbert hit the big road in a desperate search for redemption and herself to Italy and the pleasures, to India and devotion to Bali and rebirth. Not a bad trip if you can swing it, and she has, in a big, big way. Up next on Point, soul seeker Elizabeth Gilbert and her new book, Eat, Pray, Love. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Elizabeth Gilbert. Her new book is Eat, Pray, Love, One Woman's Search for Everything Across Italy, India, and Indonesia. She's also author of the critically acclaimed The Last American Man, Stern Men, and the short story collection Pilgrims. She writes for GQ Magazine. Elizabeth Gilbert, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It's nice to be here.
Wow, what a story. You are a gusher, and it gushes on and on and on. It's unbelievable. You say you could make friends with, I forget what it was, with a pile of sheetrock, and you do it all around the world. You're incredibly open about the slobbering heap that you were in before you lit out here. So we see you're quite a writer, and you've brought this all home. But beyond that, so our listeners understand, who the heck are you who set out on this journey?
Well, who was I when I set out is a little different than who I was when I came back. Mm-hmm. But I set out after about three, almost 4 years of a very deep depression that had been brought on by, I call it an early onslaught middle-age crisis. It happened when I was about 30. And my marriage fell apart, and I realized I didn't want to have kids. I didn't want any of the stuff I was supposed to want. I had a rebound relationship after that that ended in heaps of tears. And it just seemed like I needed to go on a good old-fashioned quest and see if I could bring myself back to some kind of a comprehension of myself. So that's the person who set out. And the quest was pretty specific, because I've always felt like the more specific you can be about your quest, the more likely it is that you're going to find what you need. Mm. And what I really felt like I was missing were central pillars of my humanity. And in my case, those were, I'd lost the ability to enjoy pleasure. And I had lost any sense of any connection to divinity. And those were the two main things that I went out there looking for.
Pleasure and divinity, therefore, mm-hmm. Italy and India, first stops. You end up in Bali, not a bad place to go either. And you write very persuasively that it was sort of the baby requirement that was no small part of bringing this all on. You describe being sort of crying on the floor of the bathroom, praying that you weren't pregnant when society would suggest it was time that maybe, I guess you were 31, that maybe it was time to be. So I wish you'd read some of that for us, Elizabeth Gilbert, from early on in the book, Eat, Pray, Love, so we can get a sense of the trapped woman who was looking out at the world and preparing to light out. Could you read something for us there?
Sure, no problem. I'll read it here. I was supposed to want to have a baby. I was 31 years old. My husband and I, who had been together for 8 years, married for six, had built our entire life around the common expectation that after passing the doddering old age of 30, I would want to settle down and have children. By then, we mutually anticipated, I would have grown weary of traveling and would be happy to live in a big, busy household full of children and homemade quilts, with a garden in the backyard and a cozy stew bubbling on the stovetop. The fact that this was a fairly accurate portrait of my own mother is a quick indicator of how difficult it once was for me to tell the difference between myself and the powerful woman who had raised me. But I didn't, as I was appalled to be finding out, want any of these things. Instead, as my 20s had come to a close, that deadline of 30 had loomed over me like a death sentence, and I discovered that I did not want to be pregnant. I kept waiting to want to have a baby, but it didn't happen, and I know what it feels like to want something, believe me. I well know what desire feels like, but it wasn't there. Moreover, I couldn't stop thinking about what my sister had said to me once as she was breastfeeding her firstborn. She said, "Having a baby is like getting a tattoo on your face. You really need to be certain it's what you want before you commit." How could I turn back now, though? Everything was in place. This was supposed to be the year. In fact, we'd been trying to get pregnant for a few months already, but nothing had happened. aside from the fact that, in an almost sarcastic mockery of pregnancy, I was experiencing psychosomatic morning sickness, nervously throwing up my breakfast every day. And every month, when I got my period, I would find myself whispering furtively on the bathroom, "Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for giving me one more month to live." I'd been attempting to convince myself that this was normal. All women must feel this way when they're trying to get pregnant, I had decided. Ambivalent was the word I used, avoiding the much more accurate description, utterly consumed with dread. I was trying to convince myself that my feelings were customary, despite all evidence to the contrary, such as the acquaintance I'd run into last week, who had just discovered that she was pregnant for the first time, after spending 2 years and a king's ransom in fertility treatments. She was ecstatic. She had wanted to be a mother forever, she told me. She admitted she'd been secretly buying baby clothes for years and hiding them under the bed where her husband wouldn't find them. I saw the joy in her face, and I recognized it. This was the exact joy my own face had radiated last spring, the day I had discovered that the magazine I worked for was going to send me on assignment to New Zealand to write an article about the search for the giant squid. And I thought, until I can feel as ecstatic about having a baby as I felt about going to New Zealand to search for giant squid, I cannot have a baby. I don't want to be married anymore.
Elizabeth Gilbert reading from her new book, Eat, Pray, Love, and Off. She sets for Italy and India and Bali and the search, she says, for pleasure, for divinity. We're just about ready to blast off with you, but what, was it your husband? Was it you? Was it the combo? I mean, and just how bad did it get?
Oh, it got bad. It got very bad. I mean, I've witnessed marriages that fall apart and people somehow seem to hold their dignity, but I guess we sort of couldn't do that. And it was a terrible meltdown. I think it was a combination of all of those things. And I think what happens is that there's each partner in a marriage gets two votes. You know, you get a yes and a no. And whenever a big decision comes up, you have to have a conversation to decide, is it a yes or a no? And whenever the big major decisions in our lives came up, you know, he was always a yes and I was always a maybe. And a maybe is kind of a half a yes. And so rather than hold things up, we always went with the yes. And when you continue to make decisions that way from a place of ambivalence, like not sure, but okay, you know, eventually that's a lot of right turns, you know, when maybe you should be going left or maybe you shouldn't be going anywhere. And I think that what it took me a really long time to realize is that I don't know is actually a legitimate answer, you know, and you can say that at times, and you can say, this is too fast, or I'm not certain. And somehow I continued to say yes, yes, yes to everything until it was time for the baby, and that's when I realized that's not a decision you can make from a point of maybe. That would be terribly irresible to everybody in the world.
Not a second too soon, given the ferocity with which you tore out of there, looking for pleasure, you say, looking for divinity. Pleasure came first. I mean, you start the book saying, what was it? I wish Giovanni would kiss me. You're in Rome, and you're on the trail. Pleasure as the solution to this early midlife meltdown, as you say?
I think so. I mean, I'd always been somebody who had just enormous appetites, you know, in every possible way. I just hungered for experience. I had always been that person. But depression had kind of corroded that out of me so that everything tasted like sawdust to me. Everything looked like sawdust. Everything felt like sawdust. I felt like sawdust, you know. And so I felt like I needed to kickstart that again because I do think that is, you know, one of our human rights and one that we sort of don't pay a lot of attention to here in America. I do think we're an entertainment-based culture, but I'm not sure we're a pleasure-based culture. And Italy is a pleasure-based culture, you know, and I felt like I needed to go find that part of myself that was gone, and I needed to go do it against the backdrop of a country that does it kind of professionally.
Pleasure then, on the way to God. Did Italy deliver for you, Elizabeth Gilbert?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I actually think one of the most amazing things about this whole story for me was how much it worked. You know, everything that I went out there looking for, I found. And the places that I went looking for it, I found that thing. So, Italy definitely delivered. It took the Romans a couple months to kind of beat out of me my inherent Yankee Protestant sort of work ethic. We must be producing at all times, you know. And finally, they kind of got me to relax and believe that there wasn't really anything more important than the next great meal. And I just came back, you know, I gained weight. I put on 23 pounds. which was more than I needed to. I was a little skinny when I got there, but I just felt like I expanded, literally, you know,
but
in
you,
the waist.
But you weren't kissing much. You weren't kissing Giovanni much. In fact, you weren't having sex at all.
No.
It's a funny way to go after pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's our first identification when we think of pleasure. But for me, I needed the opposite of that. I had come out of not just a failed marriage and not just a failed rebound relationship after the marriage, but years, I mean, 2 decades of nonstop, very intense romantic entanglement with boys, with men, with sometimes boys and men, you know, just like too much. And I think I needed to take myself away from that in order to discover what is it that I enjoy when I'm not trying to completely meld with another person.
We're talking this hour about one woman's globe-trotting search for everything. Elizabeth Gilbert is my guest. Her new book is Eat, Pray, Love. Liz, you're a wonderful writer. It just goes and goes and goes. I wish you'd give us a bit more, just from the very beginning, where you're wishing Giovanni would kiss you. Get us set in that Italian pleasure palace that started to get you turned around.
I wish Giovanni would kiss me. Oh, but there are so many reasons why this would be a terrible idea. To begin with, Giovanni is 10 years younger than I am, and, like most Italian guys in their 20s, he still lives with his mother. These facts alone make him an unlikely romantic partner for me, given that I am a professional American woman in my mid-30s who has just come through a failed marriage and a devastating, interminable divorce, followed immediately by a passionate love affair that ended in sickening heartbreak. This loss upon loss has left me feeling sad and brittle and about 7,000 years old. Purely as a matter of principle, I wouldn't inflict my sorry, busted-up old self on the lovely, unsullied Giovanni. Not to mention that I have finally arrived at that age where a woman starts to question whether the wisest way to get over the loss of one beautiful brown-eyed young man is indeed to promptly invite another one into her bed. This is why I have been alone for many months now. This is why, in fact, I have decided to spend this entire year in celibacy. To which the savvy observer might inquire, then why did you come to Italy? To which I can only reply, especially when looking across the table at handsome Giovanni, excellent question. Giovanni is my tandem exchange partner. That sounds like an innuendo, but unfortunately it's not. All it really means is that we meet a few evenings a week here in Rome to practice each other's languages. We speak first in Italian, and he is patient with me. Then we speak in English, and I am patient with him. I discovered Giovanni a few weeks after I'd arrived in Rome, thanks to that big internet cafe at the Piazza Barberini. Giovanni had posted a flyer on the bulletin board explaining that a native Italian speaker was seeking a native English speaker for conversational language practice. Right beside his appeal was another flyer with the same request, word for word identical in every way, right down to the typeface. The only difference was the contact information. One flyer listed an email address for somebody named Giovanni. The other introduced somebody named Dario, but even the home phone number was the same. Using my keen intuitive powers, I emailed both men at the same time, asking in Italian, "Are you perhaps brothers?" It was Giovanni who wrote back this very provocativo message. Even better, twins. Oh yes, much better. Tall, dark, and handsome, identical 25-year-old twins, as it turns out, with those giant brown liquid-center Italian eyes that just unstitch me. After meeting the boys in person, I began to wonder if perhaps I should adjust my rule somewhat about remaining celibate this entire year. For instance, perhaps I could remain totally celibate, except for keeping a pair of handsome 25-year-old Italian twin brothers as lovers, which was slightly reminiscent of a friend of mine who is vegetarian except for bacon, but nonetheless, I was already composing my letter to Penthouse. In the flickering, candlelit shadows of the Roman cafe, it was impossible to tell whose hands were caressing, but no. No and no. This was not my moment to be seeking romance, and so by now, by the middle of November, the shy, studious Giovanni and I have become dear buddies. As for Dario, the more razzle-dazzle swinger brother of the two, I have introduced him to my adorable little Swedish friend, Sophie, and how they've been sharing their evenings in Rome is another kind of tandem exchange altogether. But Giovanni and I, we only talk. Well, we eat and we talk.
And so it begins. Elizabeth Gilbert reading from the very beginning of her new book, Eat, Pray, Love. Lucia is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Lucia. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm really happy to have been listening to your program. I congratulate Ms. Gilbert for her honesty and the way she has to put an end to words her own quest. I just wanted to share very briefly to let other also listeners to participate in your program.
Yeah.
I am one of the women who for an entire generation enter corporate America teams and work very hard until I found the wall, and the wall was blank. It was asking me who I was and what I really wanted, and I left everything behind and started my own search.
Marriage, family?
I didn't leave family. I had already two boys, well, two men. One lives in New York.
Yeah.
He's very well set now as an artist, and the other one is about to being to graduate in Chicago. Now, I have a 13-year-old with me who lives with me.
And how'd you get over the wall or through the wall, Lucia? Where did you light out to, or did you?
I'm sorry, say that again?
How did you get over the wall or through
how
the wall or around?
How I did get over the wall, it was a tremendous fight. She mentioned something about motherhood and conflict inside her. The conflict comes in different ways, but there is a conflict, and my conflict was the values I had and the way I saw things evolving around me. And I cannot really give any more details without giving away some information that I don't really want to share. That's not the important thing, but the important thing was that you have to be honest to yourself. You have to understand who you are and what your identity is. What is your quest? What is your call? Now, I started participating in a lot of volunteer programs here in my community.
Yeah.
And I found... and this is the wonderful thing that I want to share, a great quantity of women who are exactly at the same point. And we participate in programs that help us also to reach across cultures, use a variety of languages, and help immigrants, for example, so that you have a look outside in the world, maybe not traveling. I would have chosen traveling. As a matter of fact, that is my dream, and I really am happy that somebody can do that. But my trip was inside, internal.
Right there, and you found it. We hear it. We hear your kind of you go girl there, Lucia. We appreciate your call. Liz Gilbert, how about it? You write, and I quoted this at the very top, Virginia Woolf, saying, across the broad continent of a woman's life falls the shadow of a sword. You say, on one side, convention, tradition, order, where all is correct, quote unquote. On the other side, if you're crazy enough to cross it, your words, and choose a life that does not follow convention, all is confusion. Is that what you found?
Initially. The crossing over of that shadow can be a confusing and chaotic and terrifying thing to do. It can also sometimes be essential. I mean, I think... For me, I wouldn't have left my marriage if I didn't have to. You know, I wouldn't have done any of this if I didn't have to, if the alternative had been livable. But the alternative had become unlivable, and I think it's often a case that people don't change their lives until the alternative is untenable anymore. What I liked about what Lucia was saying is just this idea that you must find the thing that causes you to be uplifted, that causes you to feel expansive, that causes you to resemble yourself, because that's one of the most heartbreaking things that can happen in not just a woman, in anyone's life, is when you look at your life and you suddenly feel, I do not resemble anything that's occurring around here. I think part of the problem in this culture is that we are so interfered with, you know, we're so overstressed, over-demanded, there's so much expected of us, we put so much pressure on ourselves, that there isn't really very much stillness, there isn't very, very much space where a person can have a moment to sit and actually look interiorly and say, you know, given the choice and assuming that I do have some, what kind of person am I? What do I want? Where do I want to go?
And you did that right out kind of on the very big highway of life. You quote the Bhagavad Gita, of course, the ancient Indian text, saying it is better to live your own destiny imperfectly than to live an imitation of somebody else's life with perfection. Liz Gilbert, we've got to get to that part of the question, India, but first tell us, pleasure and Italy, I mean, there's page after page here of ecstatic encounters with pizza in Naples and people and moments, but what was that reconnection with pleasure? What did it do for you on your quest? Apart from the 23 pounds.
I came home from Italy briefly before I went to India to spend Christmas with my family and friends.
Yeah.
And my friends were all saying, I've never seen you so happy. I've never seen you so, you know, joyous. I've never seen you so fat. Right. It was quite a change. You know, what it did was that it helped me start to identify that I have the right to ask myself, what would I like? You know, I mean, that's the essence of pleasure. You know, the essence of pleasure is being, you know, feeling like you're entitled to say to yourself in certain circumstances, if I could choose what I want, what would that be? You know, and food for me was a very easy doorway to go into that. You know, would I rather have gelato right now? Or would I rather have some linguine right now? Would I rather have linguine and then gelato? You know, I'd never really given myself full range to ask even such simple questions as that.
What would I like? With that found, you're on your way to India. You say the divine is the other thing you were looking for here, but yet you don't describe yourself as a terribly religious person. So help get us focused on what you were after there.
Well, I hadn't been raised as a religious person. I'd gone to Congregationalist church in New England, you know, regularly as a kid. But I don't know how familiar you are with, you know, New England Congregationalists, but we don't talk very much about God. Yeah. As my dad described, he said, I prefer a minister who sort of waves vaguely up toward the sky
and they
makes
do.
Sort of vague references. You know, I mean, you know, it's certainly not a charismatic Baptist experience.
So what were you looking for?
What I was looking for was, I'll tell you this, I did come to a search for divinity from the same place that I think many people come to it from, people who don't have it naturally or weren't raised with it. I came from a place of deep suffering, and I came from a place of deep despair, and I've heard despair translated as separation from God. And, you know, I found myself after night after night after night of, you know, crying, hiding in the bathroom in the middle of the night in my marriage and crying and crying, I found myself wanting to pray and not really knowing how to or what that even meant. And yet I did have a sense that when you are faced with eternal, bottomless suffering, the only thing that will ultimately fill it is eternal, bottomless grace. If you've got something in you that's empty, you know, I mean, my suffering felt like it had no end. So you have to fill it with the only other thing in the universe that has no end. And that's God, however you want to define that, you know. And so that's what I was looking for. I was looking for something to expand into that space, to bring lightness where the dark had been. And I think that's probably the simplest way to explain a path toward God.
India, it's kind of a cliche, and yet it works for a lot of people. It worked for you. Where'd you go there?
I went to an ashram outside of Bombay, and I stayed there. I had intended to only stay a month and then go traveling around India looking for God, which was kind of funny because once I started to spend hour upon hour upon hour, you know, in meditation, it was clear that, you know, I wasn't going to be finding it anywhere other than on that meditation cushion, you know, and that this whole environment was very set up to help you do that. It is, believe me, I'm aware of the fact that it's a cliche, you know, to run off to India looking for divinity, but people have been doing it for thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
There just might be a reason.
There might be a reason.
You've divided the book into what you call beads, as in beads on a rosary or a prayer bracelet. Bead 72, if you'd read for us, you're in conversation with God a lot on this journey, sometimes angrily, sometimes lovingly, sometimes desperately. You wrote some poetry about it when you were at the ashram in India. Maybe you could read one of those poems. There's one here called First.
It's First because it's the first poem I ever wrote, and it came out of my experience in India when I was feeling a lot of frustration about the fact that, you know, when you tell people that you're going to an ashram, they sort of imagine you're going to walk around in a state of bliss with butterflies flying all over your head. You know, this was certainly not my experience. So this is the poem that I wrote. All this talk of nectar and bliss is starting to piss me off. I don't know about you, my friend, but my path to God ain't no sweet waft of incense. It's a cat set loose in a pigeon pen, and I'm the cat, but also them who yell like hell when they get pinned. My path to God is a workers' uprising. Won't be peace till they unionize. Their pickets so fearsome, the National Guard won't come near them. My path was beaten unconscious before me by a small brown man I never got to see, who chased God through India, shin deep in mud, barefoot and famished, malarial blood, sleeping in doorways under bridges, a hobo, which is short for homeward bound, you know. And he now chases me, saying, "Got it yet, Liz? What homeward means? What bound really is?"
Elizabeth Gilbert reading there, first from her book Eat, Pray, Love, Michael in Billerica, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael, are you there?
Yes, hello. First off, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to relate my own experience. I graduated college and worked a decent office job with decent people, but one that wasn't satisfying personally to me. Long story short, I took off. I went for a month to Africa, climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and then went for a month to Eastern Europe. It was a two-month trip total, and it was absolutely wonderful. I think everyone should have the opportunity to do it.
And is that it? You just climb Mount Kilimanjaro, go to Eastern Europe, and you've got samadhi, you've broken through, you've found the brass ring, Michael?
Well, that is kind of what I wanted to touch upon. I had sort of this naive belief before I went to that, yeah, you know, once you did that, you would come home and you would just get it, you know, somehow you'd magically, I don't know, sit around in a lotus position all day. And one thing I found that it was a positive experience, but in very subtle ways, in that I'm more able to allow myself to enjoy things now. The person you're interviewing definitely talks a lot about this Puritan work ethic, and that was definitely drilled into me. It's so much more subtle than I would have imagined. That's one thing I want to see what she had to say about. The other thing I want to say that I noticed was it seems to be I was brought up in a middle class to upper middle class family.
Yeah.
Seems to be almost a privilege to be able to do this. In other words, when I was traveling in all of the countries I went to, I didn't really seem to meet anyone who was from, like, you know, like an urban lower class background or African Americans. It seemed to pretty much be middle to upper middle class white folk. And I was wondering if she had encountered any, you know, anybody who had, like, grown up in, you know, I don't know, Dorchester or Roxbury or something like that.
Michael, we've got it. Our time is short, but thanks for your call. Liz Gilbert, how about it? I mean, that plane ticket doesn't come cheap. Plane tickets that took you to all those corners.
It doesn't, and I think that's by and large the truth. It is a great luxury to be able to do something like this.
We're talking this hour with magazine writer, novelist, and out with a new memoir, Elizabeth Gilbert. It's called Eat, Pray, Love: One Woman's Search for Everything Across Italy, India, and Indonesia. Annalise is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Annalise, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
It is actually stories like these that are so powerful to me and make me so adamant in never coming to this brick wall. I am actually only 22 years old and graduating college in May and joining the Peace Corps, and have just decided, after hearing stories like that and reading different short stories and books and magazines, that I am determined to never come to that wall and to never come to that question of what am I here for, what am I trying to do in this life, but to go ahead and set out and discover it all and have a good idea of
Wonderful. We hear it, and you want to do it from the get-go. Liz Gilbert, what's your advice? Annalise, heading into the Peace Corps, 22, never wants to hit the wall. I'm sure you didn't either. What's your advice?
Well, one, rock on, Annalise. You know, that's wonderful to hear. And you know, bless your heart. That's fantastic. You know, I was very much like that as well when I was 22. I've always been like that.
And yet, there you were at 31.
And yet, every once in a while we make decisions that later we find out weren't the right ones, and they need to be remedied. And I do think that as conscious as you can be, you know, the better your luck of finding that. But I love her spirit, and I just can't wait to, you know, see what she's going to go do. It's so great to see somebody on fire like that at such a young age and feel like she's entitled to go and do that.
But I'm betting you were on fire too, and I'm betting you also felt entitled. So looking back, oh, learned one, back from your world travel, how would you have set the combination on the lock differently there?
I try not to do too much of, like, you know, what I should have done differently. I mean, I think that what happened is what needed to happen for all sorts of reasons. But I do think that I can understand what happened, which is that I was trying to do two things simultaneously. I was, by the time I reached about 25, 26, I was trying to be, you know, gypsy artist, traveler, writer, adventure girl, and good wife, you know, suburban housewife, you know, settling down to have a family. And, you know, I mean, I was part of the generation that was raised to think that you actually can do everything, you know. And I have examples in my family of women who certainly look like they can do everything.
And now what do you think?
And now I have very, very humble, you know, respect for the things that I'm not capable of doing all at the same time, you know. And there are decisions that I've had to make and things that I've given up because I realized that, you know, there's a destiny that I've got that's specific to me, and it doesn't quite benefit anybody if I try to sort of bend and shape and force myself into roles that I can't handle.
Mm-hmm. Annalise, good luck to you on your trail. Loretta's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Loretta, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to hear Ms. Gilbert's comments, and maybe this comes later in your book. I don't know that the program is going to be long enough. How you reflected on the connection between sexuality and spirituality. You had a lot of freedom, it sounds like, in the beginning. It only led you to a spiritual quest and a year of celibacy. I don't know how you reflected back on the freedom of sexuality or the resumption of sexuality in the light of a spiritual insight. And I'd love to hear your comments on that, your reflections.
Loretta, that's great. Liz Gilbert, celibacy and sexuality.
Can I just say how much I'm loving being an expert on on sexuality and spirituality? You know, I'm no more of an expert than I think, you know, anybody else is on this. I responded, you know, at that point in my life in the way that I felt necessary. I did think that I needed to have a break from that for a lot of emotional and psychological reasons. You know, I think in the West we tend to look for clean divisions. We want our spirituality, you know, very organized. You know, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad. You know, here's your packet. You know, follow the directions accordingly. I think that what I have come away with is a recognition that it's a little more subtle and a little more complicated than that. I spoke to a monk about it when I was in India and said, you know, what are your feelings on sexuality? And he said, first of all, you're asking me. You know, I'm a celibate. Yeah. I'm hardly the expert. But he said, I will tell you this, you know, I'm not going to tell you, we in this part of the world are never going to tell you that you're going to go to hell for experiencing your sensuality. That said, do recognize that any time you and your body and somebody else's body come into contact, that intimacy, a great deal is exchanged. And you will leave with something of that person in you, and they will leave with something of you in them. So be careful who you do that with. You know, and think about who you do that with, and think about why you want to do that with that person. And to me, that felt like a very kind and sort of respectful and reasonable answer to that question. And although I do remember also that when I was talking to him about my divorce and troubles, at the end of the conversation, he gave me the best advice he could, and then he kissed his robes. He kissed the hem of his monk's robes. Yeah. And I thought it was some super arcane kind of like Hindu practice. I said, what are you doing there? And he said, I'm just kissing my robes and thanking God I'm a monk and I don't have to deal with this stuff anymore. So, you know, I think there is a courage in continuing to engage, you know, with human beings on the level of sexual intimacy as well, rather than just retreating from it forever.
It's a long trip for some good, simple advice there. Loretta, thanks for your call. Barbara's calling from, wait for it, Morogoro, Tanzania. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys?
We're fine. How on earth are you listening to us in Tanzania, Barbara?
I listen to you on a satellite radio.
Terrific. What do you know?
It's cool. I just want to commend your reader for stepping outside the box, or your writer, excuse me, for stepping outside the box. I think as Americans, we're taught this really amazing work ethic and going for the ultimate in perfection and efficiency, and that's life. And I'm just really happy to say that doesn't necessarily have to be life, and life is what you make it.
Barbara, what are you doing in Morogoro, Tanzania?
I work here. I work in HIV/AIDS education. I'm also working in community development, and I work for the Lutheran Church here. And I kind of ran away from home. That's maybe not quite the right way of saying it, but I wanted to do something different, and I've found my life here. It's great.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm not worried about my 401k, but I'm living and it's good.
There's a shout out from Tanzania that says, says go for it. Not just you, Liz, but I guess just go for it, period.
Somehow, Tom, when I heard someone was calling from Tanzania, I didn't think she was going to say, I don't think all this traveling is a good idea.
Right.
I thought we might be getting an endorsement there.
That's just
wonderful.
Barbara, we wish you luck with that. And thank you so much for calling. Call us again from Tanzania. And good luck with your HIV/AIDS work there. Liz Gilbert, how close did you get to God? Did you shake hands? It wasn't all, as you say, butterflies. You were meditating in a dark cave. What'd you find?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's funny. Your other caller, Mike, had sort of referenced this. I think that we tend to think that enlightenment is a place. It's a destination. It's like it's an altitude, and you climb up it, kind of like climbing Mount Everest, and then you get there, you know, and you can have someone take your Polaroid there, and you can say, on August 3rd, you know, 1996, here's me holding the flag that shows it, you know, and that's of course not how it is. It's a journey. It's a process. It's a constant, you know, it's a constant effort. And you know, I wasn't always feeling particularly connected to God when I was in India, in the middle of these sacred places, whereas sometimes here in Philadelphia I do get it. You know, I did come away with a very much more highly evolved comprehension of how to do that. And I think the most essential thing I came away with after all of those hours and months of meditation was a greater comprehension of how my mind works. You know, it's almost like I came away with an operating manual for who Liz Gilbert is and how she operates and what her mind patterns are. And I came away with wonderful new techniques on how to still that person and calm that person and love that person. And that, I think, is when I feel like I'm closest to God, is when I'm operating at the highest level of self-affection, from which comes a wellspring of great empathy for everyone else as well.
Lee's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Lee, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of thinking about life and travel and wish that I had the opportunity to bust loose and tear up the whole world.
Yeah.
I don't know where I would choose to go first if I were handed all of the resources I needed to get there. My life changes have taken a more local focus, I guess you would say.
And has that worked?
Well, several years ago I adopted a child and became a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And then just recently, it's almost a midlife crisis. I'll be 40 very soon.
Yep.
And I applied to law school.
To become a big shot on Wall Street, or to appeal before the Supreme Court? What's your goal?
Well, who knows? Anything is possible, as I think Elizabeth would agree. But what I have discovered about divinity in myself is that I always feel much closer to grace when I am of use or service to others. Mm-hmm. So I've actually gotten into some work in juvenile advocacy.
We hear
to become a juvenile advocate.
Yeah, we hear it, Lee, and applaud your stepping out there. And you raise something interesting here. Liz, you can hear it. Just almost in contrast to your comment just now, saying, you know, when you get closest to self-affection and closest to yourself, you're of the most use. Lee's saying she feels closest to God when she finds that grace of doing things for others. I mean, there is a kind of deeply self-absorbed quality to this global journey that you are on. What do you make of that?
Well, actually, I would say I don't see a difference between those two things. I think it's a pipeline that runs both ways. You know, I
mm-hmm.
think the empathy pipeline can be accessed at either end. And I think that, you know, service to others is service to self. Service to self is service to others. And what I had found before I left on this journey was that I had become a fairly useless human being in terms of what I offered everyone else. I mean, I remember this one day coming home on the subway in New York, and I was so distraught that I actually started crying on the subway openly. And I remember, you know, when I look back on it now, I think, you know, I feel sorry for that girl who was crying on the subway, but I also feel very sorry for those poor New York commuters. Like, they don't have enough in their day that they have to sit and watch somebody, like, with tears and snot running down her face. I had become that person, you know, who brought that into every room. And having taken a year out and gotten my life in order and straightened myself out, I am now a benevolent force, you know, for everybody else as well, and much more available to service of other human beings. And I actually do think that in a way that 1 year, you know, that I gave to myself to put myself in order was ultimately an act of community service to everybody around me. And it has made me somebody much more capable of giving.
Well, look at how you finally rounded that corner in Bali. But let me get another call or two here. Colin's calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Colin, you're on the air.
Hi. Let's see, this is pretty closely related to what you were just talking about,
mm-hmm.
but I find that a lot of people who I know, and I've done it myself in a way, travel the world or to parts of the world and are there trying to figure something out for themselves or explore a little bit. But it ends up, it affects them, and then when they go back home, they're maybe a better person, so to speak, but it's kind of like they're going over there, getting what they need out of it, whether it's commercial or spiritual or whatever, and then coming back to the U.S. and not really contributing a whole lot to the places they're visiting. And I think travel's a wonderful thing, and everyone who possibly can should experience, get some world travel in, but I was wondering if you could respond to that concern.
Sure, we'll pick it up, Colin. Thanks for your call. Liz, I have to say, there's plenty of interaction here. May not be sexual, but plenty of interaction. I do see the giving going both ways in your story. But how do you respond to Colin?
Well, I think, you know, I see, having traveled in a lot of third world countries, one of the best ways that an individual person can directly impact a third world country is to go spend their American dollars there. You know, I mean, just to put it on the simplest, most commercial level, I think that that's one important thing that you can do. I mean, my God, when I was in Bali, people were telling me, begging me, tell your friends in America, please come to Indonesia. You know, nobody's come here since the bombings. Mm. Everybody's so afraid, and we're all dying, you know. So that's one aspect. The other thing is that I do think that there's a great deal of giving that happens. You know, I traveled not just in Bali. I didn't actually get to writing about it in the book, but mm-hmm. I traveled around some of the Muslim parts of Indonesia, mm-hmm. To Lombok, to Sulawesi. Mm-hmm. And what I found there, which I found very saddening, was that I was the first American. In Sulawesi, my friend and I, who traveled together, were the first Americans that anybody had seen there in about 7 years.
The world,
you know,
has closed down a lot lately.
I have a big problem with mm-hmm. that. You know, mm-hmm. I have a big problem with the fact that those Muslims in Indonesia have no face for America other than what they see on television.
So just and showing up maybe something to be
I
done
think here. That I felt like a personal ambassador. You know, I just felt like I would like to have these people have a slightly different association of America than what they may have been getting through the news.
Let me get one more quick call here, if I may, Liz. Jude's calling from Westerly, Rhode Island. Hi, Jude. You're on the air.
Hi. I can hardly hear you, but I was calling because I think this subject, I am so grateful that you're covering this. It is a topic that in this country, we don't look at our lives enough. And this journey that you've written about, that you've taken, whether it's a journey of travel or whether it's a journey where you never leave your home, it's a journey that each of us have to take. This journey toward what is the truth, what is at the center of everything, is our connection with everything.
Jude, that's all we're going to get of it today. Our time's so short, but we appreciate the applause line there. Liz, I've got to ask you at the end, you come back to a guy, Philippe, he's Brazilian, yeah. You find him in Bali, it's all kisses and love and beauty, and is that the end of the circle, back in the arms of a man and everything's fine now?
Well, you know, it is a very romantic ending. It was a very romantic ending. You know, I mean, I couldn't do anything but report the book as it turned
yep.
out. And it certainly wasn't what I had expected to find or what I had gone seeking. But I did find a wonderful guy who is still, you know, he's downstairs having coffee waiting for me to finish here actually right now. So it's still very much continued almost 2 years later. And it's a lovely, unassuming, gracious love story that I think that after all that work on myself, I was finally ready to receive.
And in the half minute we've got, how are you different in this relationship from the crying in the bathroom at midnight when you left?
I think I'm a whole hell of a lot easier to live with now than I was before. I know myself better. I have less expectations for other people to make me happy. I have the keys to my own contentment. I think it makes you a better partner when you're a better self, and that's probably the simplest way to answer that.
There's the story at the end of a long story. Elizabeth Gilbert, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth Gilbert, her new book is Eat, Pray, Love, One Woman's Search for Everything Across Italy, India, and Indonesia. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Riley, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette and Vince Fairchild. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.